Ahmadinejad goes to Lebanon. Gates says Don't Ask, Don't Tell should be left to Congress. The scandal of crisis pregnancy centers, a rare new view of unborn life, week on and week off parenting, texting no longer just for teens. It's Friday, October 15, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has spent the last couple of days in Lebanon, and as usual, he is making quite a ruckus wherever he goes. The Iranian president is there because Lebanon is largely under the sway of Hezbollah, a Shiite-backed militia that is largely supported by Iran and directed. In fact, some people believe that Lebanon is becoming a shadow state of Iran and a part of a general Shiite coalition with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad at the very top. In the course of his events in Lebanon, Ahmadinejad spoke at a large rally sponsored by Shiite militia groups, and there he suggested, for instance, that it was the United States that was the real terrorist power. Speaking of Lebanon, he said this, "Lebanon is an example for the unwavering resistance to the world's tyrants and a university for jihad." Now, if the United States is watching this with interest, Israel is watching it with a far more direct sense of threat. You'll recall that President Ahmadinejad has repeatedly suggested that Israel should be cast into the sea. He has called for the end of the Jewish state, and he refers to both Israel and the United States as occupying powers, crusader state powers, in what he claims are Muslim-dominated and rightly Muslim-identified lands. Now, when you look at what's going on in Lebanon with Ahmadinejad, it's a reminder that in the Middle East, things are never simple. Lebanon used to be a thriving democratic power. It used to be the resort city of the Levant. It was a Mediterranean resort that was largely populated by Christians, Maronite Christians, who formed a great deal of the population there. For a long time in Lebanon, Muslims and Christians and Jews lived in relative harmony. But with the militarization of the area, especially in the wake of the 1973 war and the various skirmishes between Israel and Lebanon, and far more importantly, a civil war that threatened to divide Lebanon in two, the reality is that Lebanon is now more or less a fragile, if not a failed, state. Now, as we watch this issue, let's remember also that when Ahmadinejad went to Lebanon, he spouted hatred of the Jews, of Israel, and he spoke of denying both the Holocaust and the 9/11 terrorist attacks in the United States, suggesting that those attacks were an American conspiracy and the Holocaust was not real. Under Ahmadinejad, and frankly going all the way back to the Ayatollah Khomeini, Iran has become a rogue state. There had been high hopes that time would mellow the Iranian regime. If anything, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit to Lebanon has indicated that there's no mellowing going on here. As we pray for the peace of all the peoples in the region, this visit is another signal that the struggles, tensions, and stresses in this area are so complicated that it is hard to know where the tension will erupt next. This much is clear: wherever Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is, there is going to be tension present. The Obama administration's announcement yesterday that it would appeal the judge's ruling in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was something of a surprise, at least in terms of the speed with which the administration responded to the decision that was handed down by a federal judge just a few weeks ago. When that stay was relieved just about 48 hours before the White House acted, we knew that the White House had 60 days to make a decision. It actually made the decision quite quickly. Now, part of the rationale for that decision-making is becoming more clear. The Wall Street Journal reports that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates had intervened to suggest that the situation that would be required, if indeed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is immediately revoked, would be so complicated that it would lead to consternation and great confusion in the armed forces. Speaking after the White House decision, Secretary Gates said that it is Congress rather than the courts that should decide the issue. Speaking in the Pentagon's review that is upcoming in a matter of weeks, he said, and I quote, "We have a lot of revisions of regulations that has to be done, in addition to the training." He went on and said that the Pentagon's review would include surveys of service members and their spouses. He added that it couldn't be rushed. Quote, "One of the results of this review will be what kind of other changes we need to make. This is a very complex business. It has enormous consequences for our troops." End quote. I want you to note that last statement very clearly. The issue of the revocation or cancellation of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy doesn't affect merely the military. The military is the direct referent of that policy, but the push for the full normalization of homosexuality has largely been driven by the idea that the military and the institution of marriage are the two major obstacles to that full normalization. But those who are suggesting that no great changes will be necessitated by revoking Don't Ask, Don't Tell just need to listen to Secretary Gates. This Secretary of Defense is actually more or less for revoking the policy, but not just under any terms and not immediately. Now, many members of Congress are not where Secretary Gates is on this issue, but the Secretary of Defense is at least speaking reasonably about the scale of changes that will be necessary. When people tell you it's no big deal, listen once again to the Secretary's statement. He said, and I quote, "One of the results of the review will be what kind of other changes we need to make. This is a very complex business. It has enormous consequences for our troops," end quote. That statement is incommensurate with the claim that this is an inconsequential policy change. It obviously is not inconsequential. Now, when Judge Virginia Phillips handed down her decision rendering the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy unconstitutional, you'll remember that she did so against the claims of the government and the military that the policy was necessary for unit cohesion and military readiness. The judge decided that her judgment on those matters was superior and more important than that of the military. But you'll also recall that the issue of change was very much a part of this. Judge Phillips said that there was no evidence that any adequate amount of change would be necessary to make this an unworkable proposal. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this works out. When you think about the close confines of the military and the total and comprehensive structure of military life and regulations, you realize that changing something like allowing the full deployment of openly homosexual persons is not just about combat. It's not just about even units and fighting forces. It's also about housing arrangements. It's about fringe benefits and the recognition of relationships. It's about child care and all the rest. Secretary Gates, if anything, was understating the case when he spoke of how complicated and complex this entire picture really is. We should note that many are minimizing the scale and scope and cost of these changes. We should not be among them. This is a major social, moral, and institutional change that will affect not only the military, but the rest of American society. Reading the New York Times, I was struck once again by the paranoia of the pro-choice left. I call it pro-choice because that is their self-designated label. In reality, a good many are not only pro-choice, they are openly pro-abortion. The New York Times is one of the most pro-abortion papers in America. Writing in a recent edition, Susan Dominus of the Big City column is writing about crisis pregnancy centers in Manhattan. She writes an ominous headline, "Throwing Light on the True Agenda of Crisis Pregnancy Centers." Now, this is the way the liberal argument works. These crisis pregnancy centers are actually disguised locations for pro-life indoctrination. They suggest that they send a wrong, indeed a dishonest message, by advertising services for those who may have an unwanted pregnancy, only to get these women into a context in which what really goes on is trying to talk them out of having an abortion. Now, when you look at this, you recognize that something more than just facts, well, something more than just data is at stake here. Now, let's ask an honest question. Do we really believe that these crisis pregnancy centers, sponsored by pro-life organizations, are there merely to offer advice without any counsel or encouragement to save the baby? Of course not. The very logic of these crisis pregnancy centers is to do, in terms of their agenda, and to set as their aim, exactly what the New York Times here tries to unmask as some kind of hidden conspiracy. But when it comes to reaching out to women who are in need, some of the pro-life sources cited in the story pointed out that it is groups like Planned Parenthood who actually do the same thing from the other side. Do we really expect that someone going into a Planned Parenthood clinic is going to get counsel that is ideologically and value-free? Of course not. Planned Parenthood advocates for abortion, suggests that in many cases, if not most, abortion is the superior choice. Planned Parenthood actually makes a profit from abortion, something no one would claim that pro-life groups are seeking through their crisis pregnancy centers. Let me tell you what's really going on here. When you look at the major shifts in public opinion, in moral and value opinion on the issue of abortion over the last several years, it is clear that the tide is turning against the pro-abortion argument. There are many reasons for this. It is documented in the fact that every coming generation for the last several years has been more rather than less pro-life. One of the reasons for this is that the ultrasound and the evidence coming in about the humanity of the unborn child is making it very difficult to deny that baby's humanity. This is the generation, as many have pointed out, who have had up on their refrigerators pictures of little brothers and sisters in utero through these magnificent and sophisticated ultrasound documents. Now, when you look at this, you recognize that the eyes are now telling the heart something the heart desperately needs to know. I'm thankful these crisis pregnancy centers are working. Time magazine, about a couple of years ago, ran a similar story trying to expose the true agenda of these crisis pregnancy centers. I'll tell you what you have to do to expose it. Ask them. Just a week after the Nobel Prize for Medicine went to the doctor who was the pioneer of in vitro fertilization treatment, Time magazine and other media are reporting on a new technology that has emerged at Stanford University. At that university, IVF technicians have been able to film, that is, to gain photographic images of human embryos and their division and growth within even the first 48 to 72 hours after fertilization. This takes place in a lab dish, of course, in terms of in vitro fertilization, and this new technology allows human eyes to see what our eyes have never been able to see before. Going back to the very earliest stages of the embryo's development, that is, the first 48 to 72 hours, the technicians can now look and see and actually determine which of the embryos that may be in a dish or in a sample from a respective individual may be most likely to succeed when implanted into a woman's womb. Now, the ambition behind this technology is to be able to increase the likelihood of success of IVF treatments. But the point I want to make to you is that the eye is now seeing something the human eye has not seen before. Now, this remarkable microphotographic technology has allowed some things that, well, previous generations couldn't even have imagined. We have seen, by the miracle of this technology, things that our eyes never expected to see. And the sights that are seen by our eyes inevitably influence our hearts. That's why, as we spoke just a moment ago, the ultrasound images are having such a massive impact on the question of abortion. Well, when you think about so many of these issues of reproductive technologies and such things as human embryonic stem cell research, I think this new technology, which was designed in order to help the technicians increase the likelihood of IVF success, is also going to demonstrate the miracle of the human embryo, even at these very earliest stages, just 48 hours or so after fertilization. The reality is that when you see this embryo at work, when you see this embryo forming, you understand that this is not just some kind of chemical process. This is not some kind of biological accident. This is a human being coming into view, a miracle of life. That means that every one of our lives is discounted if it is disrespected, much less destroyed. Time magazine is out with a very interesting story about what it calls week-on, week-off parenting. The subtitle of the article is Revisiting a Radical Experiment in Work-Life Balance. Belinda Luscombe is the reporter, and to be honest, I'd not seen this kind of pattern before. It turns out that this is about having two parents who hold one job, the husband and the wife, who hold one job. One works 1 week, and then one works the next week, so that together they form a full-time employee. It allows them to go back and forth in terms of work and home responsibilities, working in the home 1 week, working in the workplace the next week. Now, why, you might ask, would anyone try to go to that kind of trouble? Well, it's because those who are committed to full gender equality are finding it very difficult to do so with two different jobs. It turns out that study after study indicates that women, because of their larger domestic responsibilities, and also, as this article does acknowledge, because of their greater likelihood of them wanting to be in the home, they're finding it that it's often the case they fall behind professionally when their husbands do not. Now, if you read this article, you have to scratch your head and wonder how many jobs could actually be held by a husband and a wife amounting to one full-time employee. The answer to that is obvious, as this article basically admits. It isn't going to happen with many couples. It isn't going to happen many places. And when it does happen, it is often not very satisfactory. Now, from a Christian worldview perspective, looking at this, at least one dimension has to be that this absolute ambition to have gender equality, with men and women having the same and equal responsibilities in the home and in the workplace, just isn't going to work. You may recall that the Zapatero government in Spain a couple of years ago tried to legislate this kind of equality, only to discover that it can't be legislated. The reality is that there is a basic drive within women and a basic drive within men. There are basic issues of competence and calling that are not identical. A major article in Time magazine on week-on, week-off parenting actually serves more of an illustration of that fact than as a serious proposal about how the obstacle, as they see it, might be overcome. The law of unintended consequences sometimes plays out in the technological arena. Just consider the instrument you hold in your hand and often call a cell phone. Increasingly, it's not used as a phone at all. It's not used for voice communications. Instead, it's being used to send text messages or SMS messages that function as the basic units of communication where it used to be a conversation. Now, what all this tells us is that we are changing the way we communicate with one another, but it's telling us something else as well. It's telling us that as the teenagers go, well, the adults often follow. In a recent personal journal article in the Wall Street Journal, Catherine Rossman points out that adults are now beginning to use their cell phones to send text messages and receive them almost at the same rate as teenagers, and that can be a breathtaking rate. The Kaiser Family Foundation has reported that most younger Americans aged 12 to 18 send text messages and rarely talk on the phone, and their text messages are sent often at a rate of over 100 a day sent and received. Well, now adults are beginning to catch up. A recent study indicates that among 18 to 24-year-olds, talk time is down, text rate is up. But it's not just even those young adults. According to this research, 45 to 54-year-olds are sending and receiving 323 texts a month. Now, that's up 75% from a year ago. This article also has a very interesting aspect having to do with why there's been this shift from the phone and voice communication to the text message. College students here helped to explain it. A survey of 2,000 college students asked about their attitudes toward phone calls and text messaging found that the students' predominant goal was to pass along information in as little time, with as little small talk, and as little interruption as possible. Well, when you think about the communication needs of adults, my guess is that turns out to be very similar to those of teenagers when it comes to wanting the information short, summarized, uncomplicated, and with as little small talk as possible. It's a sad thing, however, to imagine the loss of voice communication and a lot of that small talk. What used to pass for the building of relationships and what was once central for getting to know one another is now being replaced not only with text messaging, but with an invented language that leaves out not only consonants and vowels, well, but almost any opportunity for small talk and personality. The shift from voice to text may be very efficient, but let's not kid ourselves. We're also losing a great deal in the process. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. This past week has been Heritage Week on our campus. We've had three major chapel services, enormous meetings ranging from our Board of Trustees to our Foundation Board to a preview conference that is bringing together several hundred preview students over the weekend. Now, in the chapel services on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, special services were held that you will find of interest. You'll find them on our homepage at sbts.edu. Audio, video, live streaming is available for every one of our chapel services. You can find that by going to sbts.edu/resources. I'll look forward to meeting you next week for The Briefing.